Hello, I'm Christy Jang. This is number 0354, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0354. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Bart King, author of the middle school novel for kids entitled The Drake Equation.
The protagonist of my story is a young bird watcher, and so his the story opens with him looking for a wood duck, essentially, and so his idea of the Drake Equation is going to kind of collide with the actual Drake Equation in the story.
Actress Charlotte Stewart, who played beloved schoolteacher Miss Beadle on Little House on the Prairie, has written her memoir entitled Little House in the Hollywood Hills.
I was on tour with Allison Arngrim, who played Nellie on Little House on the Prairie, and she wrote a book called Memoirs of a Prairie Bitch. It's hysterical. And she kept saying, Charlotte, you've got to write a book. I said, no, I'm not a writer. But I saw her selling them, you know, just hundreds. And I thought, maybe there's something to this tour stuff. So I was with a friend, Andy Dembski, who's a writer here in Napa. And he so kindly agreed to work with me. And so I started telling him stories.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. Book Banter takes a musical trip to 1975 and beyond with The Captain and Tennille, and Tony Tennille, a memoir. So get ready for some Muskrat Love coming up soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0354, was Christy Zhang, an anatomy and cell biology student at McGill University who also dabbles in media and communications. Thank you very much, Christy, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Okay, since the economy has been improving, at least for the most part, lenders are being a bit more generous with their terms, but even still, approving a personal loan to buy meth seems a little risky. Maybe that's why police in South Carolina arrested 58-year-old Grady Carson after he walked into Carolina Title Loan's office in Spartanburg to secure a loan against his vehicle. According to its website, the loan company provides fast cash to deal with an unexpected expense and charges interest rates that begin at 96% and go all the way up to 362%. How is that even legal? Anyway, the rates didn't seem to deter Carson. A Carolina Title Loans employee told police that Carson, who was pacing as he filled out paperwork, told her he needed the money to purchase meth. Since her manager was at another store, the worker faxed a help letter to the second employee, who contacted police. After officers arrived at the loan business, Carson was handcuffed and a search of his pockets turned up a glass container with an off-white rock-like substance inside. Carson, cops noted, stated it was cocaine, but he was not going to smoke it because he did meth. A man of particular tastes. Anyway, Carson was charged with narcotics possession and booked into the county jail. Again, judging by the rates of the loan company, I don't think Carson committed the bigger crime of the day here, but I digress. Triple Crown winner American Pharoah earned an estimated $8.6 million racing, but now retired could earn as much as $35 million just by having sex. Stallions reportedly can breed into their 20s, and the horse, now barely age 4, will have 175 conquests by the end of this summer, according to a May report by CNBC. One industry worker says Pharoah has put on some weight, spends his spare time peaceably eating grass, and looks more like a relaxed horse. Seriously, if you knew you had 175 sexual conquests planned for you, wouldn't you be relaxed? Anyway, a spokesman for the Kentucky Farm Now Housing Pharaoh says he, quote, has proven to be very professional in the breeding shed, unquote. Bow chicka wow wow. Yeah. There is minimum security, and then there is, oh, why bother security. Alaska State Troopers said a man who escaped from a minimum security facility returned 3 hours later with an SUV to pick up some of his fellow inmates. Troopers said in a dispatch that 20-year-old Joshua Yaska was seen riding a bicycle away from Fairbanks North Star Center Correctional Facility at about 1:05 a.m. Investigators said Yaska returned at about 4:20 a.m. with an Isuzu SUV, which he used to transport an undisclosed number of his fellow inmates away from the facility. The halfway house holds up to 143 minimum security inmates, and staff are instructed not to physically restrain the inmates from leaving the building. Yaska was being housed at the North Star Center while awaiting trial on charges of misdemeanor theft and making a false report. As of this press time, Yaska is still on the loose. Has anybody thought of using modern technology, you know, like maybe ankle monitors? Just asking. Meanwhile, the Keystone Fellowship Church in North Wales, Pennsylvania, has a tradition of congregants reserving pew seats by leaving Bibles in place. But 27-year-old worshiper Robert Braxton was having none of that on April 24th and took a safe seat anyway. Witnesses said when one church member gently tapped Braxton on the shoulder to inform him of the tradition, Braxton snapped and became very disruptive. Congregant Mark Storms, who was 46, flashed a gun and confronted Braxton, who punched Storms, adding, "That's not a real gun, and what are you going to do, shoot me?" Yeah, I guess you can put that under famous last words, because you know where this is going, don't you? Yeah. Storms, contending that he felt threatened, fired two shots, killing Braxton, and was charged with voluntary manslaughter. And to some, that's just being Christian. Yeah. Anyway, we have one more item, quick item here, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The Moscow Times reported in May that bailiffs in Russia's Perm region, employing originality as yet unseen in the Western world and attempting to collect an overdue debt, arrested a debtor's cat. The bailiffs listed the feline's value at the equivalent of $23, and the man came up with the sum the next day and took the cat home. The Federal Bailiff's Service explained that all of the other property in the apartment was in other people's names. Well, let's just give the Russians points for style, shall we? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? Bart King is back on the show again. He's the prolific author who has churned out such books as The Big Book of Girl Stuff, The Big Book of Spy Stuff, The Big Book of Gross Stuff, and most recently, The Big Book of Superheroes. But this time, Bart has gone in a different direction, writing his first novel. It's called The Drake Equation. Bart joins us on the line via Skype from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Bart.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
I'm guessing that I'm going out on a limb here that a book called The Drake Equation has something to do with a duck.
That, well, all the best books do. I think most of the literature lovers out there realize that it does have something to do with the duck. The quick explanation, there's a double meaning in that title, like all the best children's literature has double meanings, right? So this is a book that's intended for middle, if I did my job correctly, it's appealing to younger readers, let's say 8 to 12 year olds, but immature adults might enjoy it as well. And so the idea is that a drake is the name of any male duck. But additionally, there is a real thing called the Drake Equation. An astrophysicist named Frank Drake came up with it in the early 1960s. And it was his very complex formula for ascertaining in an educated fashion how many essentially extraterrestrial civilizations might exist in the Milky Way galaxy, so just in our galaxy alone. And based on his various criteria, the number he came up with was probably in the low thousands, that there would be, you know, so think maybe four digits in terms of how many civilizations would be out there. So this isn't just other species, like a mushroom, an inert mushroom, you know, on a moon somewhere. This is an actual intelligent, sentient being that might exist elsewhere in the Milky Way. And so that, you know, gets the mind going, of course. Now, how does that relate to ducks? Well, the protagonist of my story is a young bird watcher. And so the story opens with him looking for a wood duck, essentially. And so his idea of a Drake equation is going to kind of collide with the actual Drake equation in the story. I should point out, you know, it's published by Disney, which oftentimes garners more interest from people when they find that out.
And they do have a history with ducks.
They do. They do a distinguished duck history. So we've got that going for it. The editor for the book, her name's Tracy. She actually was the one who we spoke a little bit off the air about titles, book titles beforehand. And she was the one who sort of plucked the phrase, the Drake equation, from my manuscript, which had an unwieldy title before that, and said we should call it this. I trusted her good judgment, not just because she's a good editor, but because she's worked with Rick Riordan on the Percy Jackson books, which are fairly well known amongst my readership. So her Drake credentials. And she's also an Audubon Society member, now that I think about it. So she knows her ducks.
So, as I mentioned in the introduction, you have done several books in the past. Dare I say, I could call them investigative journalism. What made you decide that fiction was the way to go this time around?
Well, you know, like writing is an odd profession, and so I had only written nonfiction to this point, humorous nonfiction, I guess, is the way I would typify it. And you know, at some point, you want to see if you can do a change up. You know, can you be the put it this way? You know, Kyle Lowry used to be well known for driving to the hoop. I'm trying to get Canadian here for you for the NBA championships, Eastern Conference Finals. But he worked on his outside shot enough that he could, you know, add that to his toolkit, if you want to put it that way. So I was confident I could write shorter pieces of fiction. I've written shorter stories for kids before, but to actually do a novel, you know, something maybe 60 to 80,000 words, I wanted to see if I could do it.
No one ever knows if they have a book inside of them. So going back to the very first book you wrote,
sure.
Would the feelings you had when you were writing that first book that was nonfiction, were you having some of those same feelings writing your first nonfiction book?
My first fiction, nonfiction versus fiction?
Yes,
fiction?
Yes.
Gosh, that's such a good question. You know, the thing about the beauty of nonfiction is that an idea, a pure idea, or a joke, you know, a notion of something that you want to share, you can launch right into it. There's no intermediary, no couching of it. You know, you can simply present it in the best fashion you see fit. So it was very easy for me to just really the Big Book of Boys stuff was my first book for younger readers, and I wrote that pretty quickly. You know, I was able to teach full time and come up with that in about a year. It was really just a matter of kind of collating and collecting the thoughts that I was having. For fiction, it's so different and such a challenge, because you know, nothing matters if your characters aren't interesting and if they don't garner some sympathy but also maybe some frustration by the reader. And so, you know, coming up with, you can have the greatest ideas for a story, and if you don't have a character who can sort of implement them in a way that makes a reader interested, it just doesn't go anywhere. And so fiction for me, much, much more difficult. And the process was quite different, actually, with the nonfiction, which comes pretty naturally to me, I think.
So tell us a little bit about the main character and some of the story. It's a character by the name of Noah.
Noah, yeah. And, you know, this may be of interest to some of your listeners. When writing a story, there's so many places you can get writer's block. One of them for me is just simply coming up with names for characters. And so I usually, as I'm writing a story, simply quickly grab the name of someone I know, let's just say Peter Anthony Holder, and I use that as a placeholder for my character name until I can think of something better. And I'm in no hurry to do that. You know, I'm just looking for a name that has a little flair and I can pick it up down the line. Noah Groh is, in fact, the name of my nephew in real life. And he was the name that I used as that name that I kind of lunged for. He does have similarities with my protagonist, who's a seventh grade bird watcher. Noah is now in eighth grade and he's a naturalist. He does enjoy looking at birds and other wildlife and animals. So there's that kind of similarity. But anyway, the character Noah Groh in the story as a seventh grader, he's on a bus ride home and he thinks he hears a wood duck call through the window. This is not a quack. It turns out the wood ducks actually have a high-pitched whistle. They're very unusual ducks in a variety of ways, which I won't bore you with right now. But so he gets off the bus at the wrong stop, and that this kind of initiates one of the themes of the book, which is cause and effect. But Noah, kind of looking back on this event, thinks of it as a game of dominoes, not where you're playing the game of dominoes, but where you've stacked up dominoes, and you knock over one, which knocks over, of course, another and another and another. And so by getting off the bus at the wrong stop, Noah initiates the sequence unknowingly, where he will end up looking for the wood duck, actually finding an endangered species, which is a real species called the black swift, which nests only behind waterfalls, much more rare than a wood duck would be. So this is sort of the holy grail for a young bird watcher or a bird watcher of any age. And in the course of spotting this bird, he discovers, for lack of a better term, sort of an alien artifact. He doesn't know that it's an alien artifact at first, so I just gave my own spoiler alert. It's just essentially a glittery disc. But this disc has kind of strange properties. Among other things, it turns out, it's watching him. It's a human watching device. Just as Noah is a human watching another species, birds, there are, in fact, intelligent species watching us. Human watchers, if you want to kind of put it that way. And so he's been sort of selected to be the specimen that's going to be observed. And then this brings us into sort of this whole larger sphere of, if we were being watched by an intelligent species, what would they think of us? You know, would they find us to be a fascinating, enchanting, sometimes paradoxical species? Or would they find us to be less than tantalizing, confounding, and perhaps even antisocial, you know, with relationship to the rest of the universe? And so this is kind of the push-me-pull-you of the book, is Noah trying to present, once he realizes what's going on, present a good face on humanity to the observers, the off-planet observers, but reality sort of reasserting itself in a not always pretty fashion. So I'm speaking pretty generally now, but this is basically it. There's other things, you know, a girl he's interested in, a nemesis who's pursuing him, his own age. But that's kind of the overall gist of the story.
As you've just described it, I'm guessing this is not a book for helicopter parents.
Well, Noah actually is given a free rein. Noah's parents design playgrounds in the story, and they believe they're off leash parents. They call themselves free range parents is another way of thinking of them.
I love them already.
Yeah, so they are the opposite of a helicopter parent. In fact, Noah, I think, describes them at one point as submarine parents. He's trying to think of the exact opposite of a helicopter. So he's given wide latitude in what he does with some kind of 21st century restrictions that kids today might find alarming. For example, he's not allowed to have a cell phone. They don't want him to have that tether attached to him. And they sort of know how, well, anyone with a cell phone knows what kind of a strangely enslaving device it can be. So... yeah, so they're very iconoclastic parents in that respect, and Noah, as a result, is sort of an iconoclastic kid who, in a weird way, his parents really want him to go out and have adventures. Noah simply states to them overtly, "I don't want to have adventures. I want to be like, you know, the other kids in some respects." But they're sort of pushing him in that direction. Put it this way: when they ask him to play hooky, essentially, in the story, Noah's parents. And they want him to take it so seriously that he wouldn't be playing hooky, he would be living hooky. You know, just go your own way, you know, pursue your own dreams, that kind of thing. So
I've got just about a minute, but I did want to ask. I mean, you've written books for young adults and middle schoolers before. Now you've written this novel for middle schoolers. Do you have to think or write differently when you're writing for kids? Or do you just write like an adult and let the kids pick it up?
That's such a good question. You know, I think for me, I taught middle school for 15 years. And so the idea of capturing a younger voice or writing to a younger reader comes pretty naturally to me. I'm deeply immature and, you know, that's part of it. But just being around kids as much as I have seems to make it come pretty instinctively. There's like a visceral thing going on there. But that said, I think about it a lot, too. And so that has to do with everything from word choice to phrasing to sentence length to story length. I mean, you can write a 100,000-word novel for kids if you want, but it better be darn good. For middle-grade readers, that would be overly long, generally speaking. So it's something I am thinking about. You know, there's a – how about this? I'll wrap up with this. When I teach middle school, the classroom rule for myself for any lesson plan that was there should be something to think about during the course of lesson plan, something to physically do, and something to laugh at in the course of it, right? So that you've got these three things going on, thinking, doing, laughing. In fiction, you can't do that quite. You can't tell your readers to get up and do an activity like I would with a nonfiction book. So instead, I would simply have my characters go through that cycle. You know, has something happened recently to them? Have they done? You know, have they acted in a specific way? Have they thought about something meaningful or deep that has to do with the story or life in general? And have something funny happened recently? So, you know, that kind of cycle, I think, is good for maintaining interest. We'll see.
The book is called The Drake Equation, written by Bart King. Bart, thanks once again for being on the program with us.
Of course. Thank you so much, Peter. I really appreciate it.
Bart King, author of The Drake Equation. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0354, and you'll find links to Bart's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Charlotte Stewart, actress and author. She has her memoirs out called Little House in the Hollywood Hills. Plus, Stuart Nolman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. But right now, we have lots more Stuff File news on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And oh yes, a little later on, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. Anyway, back to the Stuff File news. When 39-year-old Ryan William Dixon arrived for a job interview at a taxi and shuttle company in Des Moines, Iowa, he had a little trouble parking, police say. A woman who worked for the company watched Dixon trying to park, but he couldn't drive straight and he hit two parked cars. Officers found he had gotten out of the hospital at 8 a.m., where he had been treated for his alcohol consumption and had arrived at the taxi company at 9:25 a.m. and allegedly admitted that, in the meantime, he had drunk a bottle of vodka. Yes, a breath test measured Dixon's blood alcohol at 0.273%, and he was arrested for drunk driving. So I'm going out on a limb to say that he probably didn't get the job at the taxi and shuttle company. Do you think he'll try Uber next? Sonia Farrick was employed to test illegal drugs at an Amherst, Massachusetts crime lab run by the state. But if investigators are right, she already knew she liked them. The state attorney general's office said Farrick used both drugs belonging to the lab, which were provided as samples for comparison, and samples brought in for testing in criminal cases. Investigators say Farrakh even testified and tested drugs while she was on meth, coke, LSD, and more over a span of 8 years. Now, according to Farrakh's own testimony, she even cooked drugs in the lab. She pleaded guilty to a total of 10 counts of evidence tampering, theft, and drug possession, but it's still not clear how many cases her misconduct has affected. You know, just from a logic point of view, if she got high off the evidence in a case, doesn't that prove it was really a drug? And also, I would like to know how someone testifies in court while high and nobody notices. Yeah. Anyway, a survey of college students finds that 1 in 10 checks their smartphones during sex. Not while cuddling afterward, I'm talking during sex. A reporter for the London Telegraph suggested Facebook update, almost there, might be a good example. The study, led by Konstantin Kushlev of the University of Virginia, in association with the University of British Columbia, dryly noted that less than 10 years ago, Steve Jobs promised that smartphones will change everything. Well, that proves once again that Jobs was a visionary. By the way, it's a whole other thrill when the phone is set to vibrate. So I hear. Anyway, because of its financial troubles, Detroit, Michigan can only maintain half of its city parks and playgrounds. That's why Tom Nardone runs the Mower Gang, a group of volunteers who gather every other week on Wednesdays to mow or clean a park. Because people need us, the group's Facebook page explains. Because no one else is going to get the job done, because we like to use the word because. Nardone works hard to attract volunteers and keep the projects fun. That's why the group held the Blindfold Mowing Olympics at a 10-acre park called Hammerberg. Now, 6 contestants were blindfolded and tried to mow the straightest line. 2 contestants made an X in the field as they crossed each other's paths, while 2 others mowed perpendicular to the required direction. "I could have sworn I was going straight," said contestant Jim Kaufman. Since Kaufman's line was the least crooked, he won the first prize. His prize? The used blindfolds. "I tried to make it sound like fun, and they fell for it," Nardone said. "Safer than a blindfold weed whacker competition," said one observer. You know, no matter how bad it gets, some people just won't give up on civic pride. That's almost touching to hear. So kudos to you, Tom. You can Google his name, Tom Nardone, and you'll see various news reports of the work he does in the Detroit area. And again, kudos to you, Tom. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, this next story will put under the headline of Darwin Starter Kit, because clearly this is someone with a death wish. A woman drove her vehicle through an activated railroad crossing guard outside Garner, North Carolina. Now, she did it to avoid the oncoming train. She accelerated across the tracks and hit a tree. Well, 2 weeks later, the same woman, in the same car, still with a damaged front end, was seen driving through the same crossing arm with the same warning lights and bells activated. This time, however, the car got stuck and an Amtrak train with 222 passengers hit the vehicle. None of the passengers were injured, and the driver was found walking around the scene with only minor injuries. Okay, let's hope they can get a camera on that crossing within the next 2 weeks. Because if you follow her timeline, that's clearly when she'll be back, and she clearly hasn't learned her lesson. That's why I say Darwin File Starter Kit. Just a matter of time. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Fans of Little House on the Prairie and Twin Peaks are certainly familiar with actress Charlotte Stewart. She played the beloved schoolteacher Miss Beadle on Little House and as Betty Briggs on Twin Peaks. She has just released her memoirs entitled Little House in the Hollywood Hills, where she shares her life, warts and all. Charlotte is on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, I'm here in Napa, California, where the wind is blowing and the pollen is blowing, and
I just spent the morning sneezing.
Oh,
so
dear.
So if I sound a little froggy, that's why.
Oh, dear. I sympathize. I know what that is like. Your book, which is coming out from the fine folks at Bear Manor Press, you've written...
June 1st.
Sorry?
June 1st.
Yes, June 1st. The title, as I mentioned, Little House in the Hollywood Hills. It's a memoir, so why have you decided to write this now?
Oh, gosh. I really didn't intend to, but I was on tour with Alison Orngrim, who played Nellie on Little House on the Prairie, and she wrote a book called Memoirs of a Prairie Bitch, and it's hysterical. And she kept saying, Charlotte, you've got to write a book. I said, no, I'm not a writer. But I saw her selling them, you know, just hundreds. And I thought, maybe there's something to this tour stuff. So I was with a friend, Andy Dembski, who's a writer here in Napa. And he so kindly agreed to work with me. And so I started telling him stories. And he would write them down. And the next week he'd come back and give them to me written up. And I'd tell him more stories. So he was the brains behind this. I just told the story of my life. He put it in some kind of order.
Okay. As I mentioned, people remember you well from Little House and Twin Peaks. But I'm a big, big television fan. I grew up spending my life in front of the television. I know they say that's not good for you, but I did that. and I bring that up only because two things come to mind. And people who want to know what I'm talking about, they can actually go to YouTube and find out what I'm referring to. You have played a lot of troubled youths in your career, and two of them come to mind, which are on YouTube. There's an episode of McMillan and Wife where you drug poor Sergeant Enright.
Poor guy.
And there's another one where you're keeping J.J. Jackson from Cades County captive on Cades County on an episode there. And when I was a kid, and I'm a little younger than you, so when I was a kid, I always thought that teenagers were always, or young people were depicted very strangely in television. While you were shooting these things, did you feel, well, these are not like any of the people I've ever met?
I know. I never knew anybody that kidnapped anybody or did all those weird things. But, you know, television back in the early 60s wasn't very real, you know? And I was all, because I looked so young, and I was probably in my mid-20s when I was playing 15, 16, 17-year-olds, you know, I didn't relate to it at all. But, you know, you do what's put in front of you. You know, I wasn't about to argue with them at the time, but, you know, this doesn't make any sense. I was just thrilled to meet Rock Hudson and Glenn, what's his name?
Glenn Ford?
On the other show.
Ford?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so, no, I didn't have much input as far as the script was concerned.
how did you, I mean, you did, as I say, play a lot of bad girls. So did you feel you were getting typecast back then at the time?
Well, I played a lot of ingenues, too. You know, I played Blind Rich Girl on FBI and, I don't know, something else on Mannix. And, you know, but I think I played a jailhouse escapee and one medical center, and yeah, I don't know. I was just young and said yes to everything that was put in front of me.
Well, how did you get into the business in the first place?
My grades were too poor to get into college, so I applied to the Pasadena Playhouse in Pasadena, which is the State Theater of California. I was accepted, and then I told my parents. And they were shocked because I had never, you know, talk about acting at all. I just wanted to get out of my hometown at the time because all my friends were going away. And as it turned out, I really liked it. And I was, I guess, pretty good at it because I got my first union Screen Actors Guild job when I was 19 on the Loretta Young Show.
Wow. And you had not done any, like, school plays or anything before that?
I did one school play that was absolutely horrible. And, no, I think I was a dreamer. I was a show-off. You know, I did all those things that, you know, in grammar school and high school. But, you know, I wasn't a good student at all. Didn't have my interest at all.
Well, let's flash forward to Little House on the Prairie, because that certainly was a turning point for you. I mean, you became Ms. Beetle. What was that like? I've had the opportunity to talk to Alison Arngrim several times. And besides to get into those corsets and hot clothing to shoot the show, what was it like?
Well, you know, I loved the character, Miss Beadle. She's mentioned briefly in the books as being pretty and smelled good, you know, so I didn't have a lot to go on. But I tell you, I really enjoyed working with the children. You know, they were professional. And, of course, on Mike Landon's set, everybody showed up on time, knew their lines, and worked until, you know, they were dismissed. And, you know, I respected these kids a lot. They were good. And now, in later years, Allison and I are very good friends. We travel a lot together, and Melissa Gilbert and Melissa Sue Anderson. So I was lucky to be involved with kids that weren't bratty. You know, they were professionals, and I really admired them.
That show was on for quite a few years on TV, but it certainly has legs. Are you surprised that you're still recognized for that role?
Well, now I'm not. But, you know, in the beginning, living in Los Angeles and doing Little House on the Prairie, we didn't get much attention from the entertainment industry. Nobody, you know, said, oh, that's a great show. They just thought, oh, that show. So I had no idea we had big fans. And my first jaunt to the Midwest with either, I think it was South Dakota. I went with Karen Grassley and Melissa and a couple of others, and we went to this park where there were 1,000 people cheering as we took the stage, and my mouth fell open and I actually started crying. I had no idea. So I've been going on these Little House events ever since. I'd probably go to 2 or 3 a year. I've made some good, long friendships, and I love our fans. They're so honest, and they're so real. You know, they're the heart of America.
I guess it's what they say, it's one of the big hits in the flyover states, right?
Yeah, exactly. I had no idea, but I'm going on a couple of these adventures this spring and summer. In fact, we're going to France. We have a huge following in France. I mean, so huge that Alison Arngrim learned French. She speaks fluent French now.
Wow. Besides the notoriety of being in Little House on the Prairie, you were also in Twin Peaks, which is making a comeback.
It sure is. I just finished my part on it. It's all wrapped up now. It'll go on in 2017 on Showtime. But, yeah, that was quite an adventure. There was nothing like it on TV. And I think it was the first time that a major film director, you know, did a TV series. And I think that's initially what made it so remarkable. But then the storyline, the characters, you know, it was the water cooler show. You know, people called each other the next day or at work. Did you see the show last night? Who killed Laura Palmer? It's phenomenal.
It's been a lot of years between Twin Peaks on ABC and now the revival. Was it like stepping into an old pair of shoes for you when you went back on set?
Oh, yes, it was wonderful. It was so nice because a lot of the same crew were there. I can't really tell you who in the cast, but I'm sure you've seen it all on the internet. They listed everybody in the show and who was coming back from the original. But it was just so great to see everybody. In fact, a week ago, Saturday, was the big wrap-up cast party in Los Angeles. And boy, was that a glorious event. Everybody was so happy. We were slapping each other on the back and, you know, telling stories. It was wonderful. It was so good to see everybody.
With the book coming out and Twin Peaks coming out next year, this seems to be the Charlotte Stewart Renaissance period for you.
Oh, my God. You know, I had no idea. I just turned 75. Who would have thought at my age, not only would I have a new career, but I just got married. You know, so I'm a newlywed, too.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The book is called Little House in the Hollywood Hills, and it is published by Bear Manor Media. Coming out June 1st. And Charlotte, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, Peter, thank you so much. Call me anytime. I'm available.
I will definitely keep that in mind. Actress Charlotte Stewart, author of Little House in the Hollywood Hills. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0354, and you'll find links to Charlotte's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. The Telephone Consumer Protection Act was passed by Congress 25 years ago to eliminate unwanted marketing phone calls. The law has helped cut down on unsolicited calls, but it's also been used for questionable lawsuits, too. For example, one law firm sued an NFL football team that offered to send its fans updates about the team if they wanted them. The team promised to send only 5 text messages a week, but it was sued after sending 6 texts one week and 7 another week. That case was worth $3 million. Now, some lawyers are being accused of trying to get big awards like that by using underhanded tactics to find new clients. One law firm has allegedly obtained the names and phone numbers of people who use a cell phone app that blocks unwanted calls and is calling them about potential lawsuits. Let's be fair, it's more than a little ironic that a law firm that files lawsuits over unwanted phone calls is itself accused of pestering these app users with more unsolicited calls. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And proving once again that love won't necessarily keep us together, here is Stuart Nauman. Hello,
hey,
Stu.
Peter.
Hi, Stu.
How's it going?
Just tickety-boo.
Well, yeah, love will keep us together. Think of me, babe, whenever. Some sweet-talking girl comes along singing a song, and you know the rest of that one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, because, you know, throughout the mid and late 70s, the pop music duo of The Captain and Tennille had several chart-topping hits with such upbeat songs and love ballads like Do That To Me One More Time, Muskrat Love, and, of course, their Grammy Award-winning Love Will Keep Us Together. However, as Tony Tennille has written in her recently released memoir called Tony Tennille, A Memoir, the story of her life behind the music, especially with her husband and musical partner Daryl, the Captain Dragon, certainly belied those romantic lyrics that she sang, which brought her so much success and fame.
And we had her on the program a couple of months ago, and I can clearly state that she is not looking back.
No, no. She's actually, she did with this book, but she's looking forward even more so. But it's quite an interesting book. You know, Tennille had a Southern Belle-type upbringing in Montgomery, Alabama during the pre-civil rights 1950s, in a family where music played quite a major role. Her father was a popular band leader during the 30s, but gave it up to run the family's furniture store business, and her mother hosted a popular TV talk show in Montgomery during the 50s. And she even developed a talent for the piano and as a singer, and she started singing professionally during the late 50s when she was a student at Auburn University with the Auburn Knights Orchestra. But about a decade later, when she settled in California and created a musical production called Mother Earth that was a major success, she made a connection with a keyboardist she was about to hire for the show who was to change her life for better and for worse, too. So enter Daryl Dragon, the son of Carmen Dragon, who was an Oscar-winning Hollywood composer and arranger. They joined the Beach Boys tour, where Dragon was known as the Captain of the Keyboards, hence the Captain moniker. And from there, the duo started doing club gigs across the United States and gained a cult following at a club called The Smokehouse. Now, one record they produced locally called The Way I Want to Touch You became a hit in California, and it brought them to the attention of A&M Records, where they signed a recording contract and put together their first album, Love Will Keep Us Together, where the title track hit the number one spot on the Billboard charts in the summer of 75.
Was also a bit of a resurgence for Neil Sedaka.
That's right, because he wrote the song. and that helped his, you know, his resurgence in his singing career that same year with Laughter in the Rain. But however, as Tennille effectively states through most of the book, her real life did not mirror the image the public had of her in Dragon as a happily married couple who found happiness through their music and their pet dogs. Tennille writes quite thoroughly that her life and career with Dragon was one long yet fruitless quest to reach out to him and find that emotional core that could have made him a loving husband, yet he never outwardly exhibited it, which he also expressed through many of their songs. As well, she chronicles how living with Dragon's eccentricities for such a long time had quite an almost tragic emotional effect on her. This was climaxed with the emotional meltdown she experienced while performing with the national touring company of Victor Victoria, thanks to the pressures of the constant traveling and performing that went with being part of a touring theatrical company, along with Dragon's monthly visits, which is more like an exercise in codependency on his part. So Tony Tennille has managed to write a fascinating, brutally honest show business memoir that takes the sheen off one of the most successful recording acts of the late 1970s and serves as a breath of fresh air in book form as she comes to terms with the ups and downs of a career as a professional singer, songwriter, and musician, and the partner who was supposed to provide that ideal professional and emotional balance, but just came up empty no matter how much she valiantly tried to bring that out from him. So love may have kept the Captain and Tennille together musically, but after reading this book, you'll painfully discover that love did not keep them together in reality.
I would also go one step further, and I would say that, and I don't think she really talked about this, and I certainly didn't bring it up when I had her on the program with us, but I get the feeling when you look at the problems that Daryl Dragon has, and it's not to make him a villain or the bad guy in this. I think they're both victims. I'd be willing to state that if she didn't stick around with him as long as she did,
yeah,
he probably wouldn't have survived. He sounds like somebody who is truly a loner, and all that goes with that. And he might not be around if someone wasn't there to take care of him like Tony did.
I know. I think she attributes that feeling of insecurity to Daryl's father, who always tried to one-up him. He never really gave the love and approval that fathers should give. And in fact, Tony, when I interviewed Tony for my newspaper column, and she said that there were times when, at the time of the Captain Teal's peak of their popularity, he went around saying, well, if he's the captain, I'm the admiral.
Yeah. And the problem he had with his own physical features, not liking his own eyes because of a problem that he had with his eyes, added to his insecurities. It's a sad situation. Anyway, the book is called?
It's called Tony Tennille, A Memoir by Tony Tennille. It's published by Taylor Trade, and it's $25.
And what do you recommend in a similar vein?
Well, if you're talking about 70s icons, entertainment icons, who wrote a memoir that was sort of like really, you know, eyebrow-raising and, you know, especially behind the scenes, I do recommend Barry Williams' 1992 memoir, Growing Up Brady, I Was a Teenage Greg.
Ah, yes. Know it well.
Oh, yes, because you got those, you know, for the first time, a lot of Brady Bunch fans got a, you know, behind-the-scenes look at what it was like to work on that show and the fame that went with it, and, of course, the famous, you know, incidences that were recorded in the book about, you know, him and Maureen McCormick having an affair, and also the date with Florence Henderson, Florence Henderson.
Okay, so this week's book, again, is?
It's called Tony Tennille, A Memoir by Tony Tennille, published by Taylor Trade, and it's $25.
And how can people find you, sir, Mr. Noman?
Well, not playing the keyboards on the Captain Tennille show. That was way back in 1976. But you can find me in the Montreal Times in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome, man. Yeah, love will keep us together.
Oh, gosh, that's Stuart Noman singing again, which is my cue to say, that's it. this has been Book Banter on the Stuff All program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and that singing guy, Stuart Noman.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about into the home stretch here on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I got a few more Stuff File news stories that I want to share with you right here, right now. Also, just want to mention very quickly that we love to hear from you here at the Stuff File program. Just send me an email with your thoughts or questions about the show, and we'll respond. Just email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and some of the questions might even make it onto the air in our mailbag section. So you can also find us on Facebook. Facebook users, we urge you to join the Stuff File fan page. It's easy to find. It's at facebook.com/thestufffileprogram. We'd love to have you on as part of the fun because, you know, as they say, the more the merrier. And remember, this show is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a herd of stoned sheep. I don't get to say that nearly often enough, you know that? A herd of stoned sheep, high as kites after feeding on the remains of an abandoned marijuana garden, went on a rampage through a Welsh village. The sheep nosed through people's gardens, and one even broke into a home, causing a mess in the bedroom, according to a report in the South Wales Guardian. There is a flock of sheep roaming the village, causing a nuisance, County Councillor Ian Richard told a local newspaper. We could have an outbreak of psychotic sheep rampaging through the village. Psychotic sheep. Yes. He said it wasn't the first time he'd been told of sheep acting strangely and wandering into traffic after munching on plants at a crossroads near Swansea Valley. I told the council officers to make sure it was reported to the police before removing any evidence and what looks like the dumped remains of a cannabis-growing establishment. Wow. Sheep with bad behavior. Yeah, I know. I had to. I wonder if they offer up psychedelic wool. No, of course not. That would be sheep on LSD, wouldn't it? Yeah. Anyway, still with animals, a 1,000-pound domesticated bison that was allowed to roam in her owner's North Texas home has moved on to new pastures. Bullet, the bison, was transported Saturday from Karen Showeve's home in Argyle to her new home, which she will share with two cows, 15 miles away in Flower Mound. Showeve says she was struggling to balance work and looking after Bullet and her two paint ponies, so she sold off the horses and 2 months ago advertised Bullet for sale on Craigslist for $5,960. She tells the Dallas Morning News she received several offers. Showeve describes Bullet as house-trained, although she sometimes tracks mud inside. She says the bison is good hardy stock, but not scary, and that she has a great personality. Yeah, right. As I've always stated in that song, oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, and I'll show you a dirty rug. Anyway. Alaska police say a man used a stolen front-end loader to break into a liquor store and then led officers on a low-speed chase. A witness flagged down Anchorage police at around 3:20 a.m. to report a front loader with forklift attachments that had ripped off most of the front entrance of a Brown Jug, that's an Alaskan liquor store chain. The witness said the driver went inside, took bottles, then got back on the front-end loader and drove east. During a 15-mile-per-hour chase, police followed the driver into a recreational vehicle park and blocked the only exit with patrol cars. Police say alcohol bottles were found inside the front loader, which had been stolen from a construction site. Joseph Martin is being held on suspicion of criminal mischief, burglary, felony driving while intoxicated, and other counts. Of course, he was driving while intoxicated. You'd have to be drunk to steal a front-end loader to rob a liquor store. Either that or you're an idiot. Which reminds me, yes, boys and girls, we've reached that part of the program. It's time once again for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff Off presents the Idiot of the Day.
Clearly, 41-year-old Shannon Egeland is not the sharpest tool in the shed. He was already convicted in 2014 of running a mortgage fraud operation during the 2004 to 2008 real estate boom. He has since pleaded guilty in May to the subsequent crime of deliberately having shot himself to gain the judge's sympathy and to collect a disability insurance that he had purchased only the week before. Shannon, scheduled to start a 10-year sentence for the 2014 conviction, told the judge he had been assaulted by gunfire when he stopped in traffic to help a pregnant woman, but in reality, he had ordered his teenage son to shoot him in the legs with a 20-gauge shotgun. Now, why, oh why, did Shannon think he was going to get away with this crime of allegedly helping a pregnant woman, no less, and getting shot at the same time? Well, one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0354. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0354. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. Don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR in Nashville, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and also over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.